because summer is barely upon us. Summer events are barely on us. We're still having graduations and we're in that transitional time. But there's an amazing project that has been underway for a while that's getting its first level of fruition this weekend, and that'll be Thursday through Sunday outside the Terrain Building and inside the Terrain Building, both performance of Waiting for Godot. And then that's as an extreme collaboration might be the understatement for this, but let's bring in Charlie Pepitone from the Gonzaga Drama Department to get in a little bit. Come in a little closer, Charlie. Let's just give away the story right now. It's not simply people in a theater and actors and nothing else.
No, tell me
the whole expanse.
So the idea, we're calling this, it's a new initiative between the theater and dance department and the art department and a host of other people at Gonzaga. We're calling it Zag Lab. And the idea is for students and faculty and guest artists to work a little bit differently, be intentional about working outside of our own comfort zones. And so this summer, we started on May 15. The process started way before that, developing the idea and getting the collaboration started. But we're doing Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot at the Washington Cracker Building. Terrain is co-producing this production. We're working with Matt Rood, our ceramics professor. I'm directing the show. Courtney Smith, who is our university scenic design professor and production manager. He's costume designing this time. Abby Planky, our technical director, is stage managing. And we brought in J.J. McCracken from Washington, D.C. to work as a scenic designer. But more than scenic designer, she's creating a full installation that will be set up at the Cracker Building outdoors from now. People can go and see it now. And a lot of people have stopped by. It'll be set up from now through the second weekend of September. And it will be it's an installation that's designed to change and degrade in the weather as people come by and walk on it. And so then the production of Godot has to change as the site changes. So it's a site-responsive production outdoors. So everybody's sort of working a little bit differently on this one, which is the idea.
And so there'll be this series of performances this weekend, and then you'll come back and do it at the closing in September.
That's right.
In September also. And while we'll, throughout the next half hour, we're going to get to this farther conceptually, but what were a few of the thoughts or questions of why Godot should have this extension?
Well, I started with Waiting for Godot because it's the play that got me into theater. So just personally, I read this as a sophomore in high school. I wasn't much of a student. And I guess out of desperation, my teacher tossed me Waiting for Godot. I read it and decided this is what I want to do. This is the sort of theater that I want to play with. So it's been in my brain for years to direct. And Godot's been done, it's been done over the years at the site of social strife. He wrote it after World War II and all of the societal upheaval that happened there. It was produced in 93 in Sarajevo by Susan Sontag. That production with refugees from the war performing it has been credited with bringing an end to the war, hastening the end to the war. Wendell Pierce, the famous actor from New Orleans, staged it in 2007 in the Lower Ninth Ward when no one was coming and everyone was waiting for help. And so we decided these are absurd times that we're living in. So we need an absurd voice to respond to an absurd time. And it's a surprisingly funny, approachable way to talk about what's going on in the world. And the biggest problem I think we're facing now is climate change and consumption and all the impact on the earth. And so that's the backdrop that we're setting our production against.
And so do you happen to know, has it been done in Spokane in recent decades?
I haven't seen a production done, not in recent decades. Mm-hmm. I've no doubt it has been done mm-hmm. somewhere mm-hmm. in Spokane. It's one of the most produced plays. The English National Theater calls it the most pivotal play of the 20th century. So I'm sure it's been done in Spokane.
Well, let's start with the play, and then we'll stretch out to all of the other elements that are happening in this total experience. The play centers around two characters. Briefly describe these two characters.
Right, Vladimir and Estragon. The play opens on a country road with a tree and nothing else around. Vladimir and Estragon are two aging tramps who the script tells us, just to paint the picture in your minds, bowler hats, think an obvious nod to Charlie Chaplin. Beckett loved Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin. And so when we meet these tramps, they're waiting. They're sitting under a tree. There's nothing else around on a country road. And they're scratching, they're dirty, they're in pain, and they're sort of just waiting. Passing the time.
And so, actually, I'm going to do one more thing before we get into them, and that's to ask Courtney to go to a microphone and describe, based on what Charlie just said, how you costume these tramps.
Yeah, so it's taking the traditional approach to the bowler hats and the coats and the layering of garments, but really they are rooted from JJ's installation. It's like they have come from her work. So that was one of the things that inspired me as the designer, is to see where she was approaching it, taking that approach from, and then kind of further pushing that boundary. You know, we're talking about clay. Our actors are covered in clay. So they really are just inhabitants of this installation.
Okay, good. That's the costumer, Courtney Smith. And we're almost about to get into the first sequence of that play. And the two actors, I'm going to ask you to do something, and that's just so that we on radio can really distinguish between the two of you. Mm-hmm. I think the first person who speaks was in this is Vladimir. So we'll do the run in a minute, but just deliver your opening line, Elizabeth, as Vladimir.
Okay. One of the thieves was saved. A reasonable percentage. Go, go.
And so now let's hear the other voice of Estragon.
What?
I'll just say a few more Estragon
repented
things.
Repented what? Our being born? Good. Dreadful provision.
So there we already hear the kind of different characters, the different energy levels of the two people. So now I think we're set up to hear this.
Great.
To hear this scene from the play, Waiting for Godot.
One of the thieves was saved. A reasonable percentage. Go, go.
What?
Suppose we repented.
Repented what?
Oh, we wouldn't have to go into the details.
Our being born.
Oh! One daren't even laugh anymore!
Dreadful provasion.
Merely smile. It's not the same thing. Go, go!
What is it?
Did you ever read the Bible?
The Bible? I must have taken a look at it.
Do you remember the Gospels?
I remember the maps of the Holy Land. Colored they were, very pretty. The Dead Sea was pale blue. The very look of it made me thirsty. That's where we'll go, I used to say. That's where we'll go for our honeymoon. We'll swim. We'll be happy.
You should have been a poet.
I was. Isn't that obvious?
Where was I? How's your foot?
Swelling visibly.
Ah, yes, the two thieves. Do you remember the story?
No.
Shall I tell it to you?
No.
It passed the time. Two thieves crucified at the same time as our Savior. One.
Our Savior?
Our Savior. One is supposed to have been saved and the other damned.
Saved from what?
Hell.
I'm going.
And how is it, this is not boring you, I hope, how is it that of the four evangelists, only one speaks of a thief being saved? The four of them were there, or thereabouts. And only one speaks of a thief being saved? Come on, go, go, return the ball, can't you, once and away?
I find this really most extraordinarily interesting.
One out of the four. Of the other three, two don't mention any thieves at all, and the third says that that both of them abused him.
Who?
What?
What's all this about? Abused who?
The Savior.
Why?
Because he wouldn't save them.
From hell?
Imbecile, from death!
I thought you said hell.
From death!
Well, what of it?
Then the two of them must have been damned.
And why not?
But one of the four says that one of the two was saved.
Well, they don't agree, and that's all there is to it.
But all four were there, and only one speaks of a thief being saved? Why believe him rather than the others?
Who believes him?
Everybody. It's the only version they know.
People are bloody ignorant apes. Charming spot. Inspiring prospects. Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Gatto?
You're sure it was here?
What?
That we were to wait?
He said by the tree. Do you see any others?
What is it?
I don't know. A willow?
Where are the leaves?
It must be dead.
No more weeping.
Or perhaps it's not the season.
Looks to me more like a bush.
A shrub.
A bush.
What are you insinuating? That we've come to the wrong place?
He should be here.
He didn't say for sure that he'd come.
And if he doesn't come?
We'll be back tomorrow.
And then the day after tomorrow.
Possibly.
And so on.
The point
until
is,
he comes.
You're merciless!
We came here yesterday.
Ah, no. There, you're mistaken.
What did we do yesterday?
What did we do yesterday?
Yes.
Why, nothing is certain when you're about.
In my opinion, we were here.
You recognize the place.
I didn't say that.
Well.
That makes no difference.
All the same. That tree. That bog.
You're sure it was this evening?
What?
That we were to wait.
He said Saturday, I think.
You think?
I must have made a note of it.
But what Saturday? And is it Saturday? Is it not rather Sunday? Or Monday? Or Friday?
It's not possible!
Or Thursday?
What do we do?
If he came yesterday and we weren't here, you may be sure he won't come again today.
But you say we were here yesterday.
I may be mistaken. Let's stop talking for a minute, do you mind?
All right.
There we go. A scene from Waiting for Godot, done by the two people, the high energy Vladimir, done by Elizabeth Spindler, and the more laid back, or that's not even the right word, but bored or something, Estragon, done by Talina Lane. Let's talk with you for just a few minutes about inhabiting these characters. Did either of you know the play at all before suddenly you found out that this existed? Had you encountered it? Had you heard it?
I had heard of it.
Yeah.
But I probably had to read it for high school or something, but I didn't. So I never read it before starting this process.
Yeah. Like Charlie, I read it in high school, and I definitely clinged on to it after that. I remember the show.
So then when you were being cast in it, you had to encounter these two characters. And talk a little about how to find your characters, and especially you, Talina. Is there kind of an interesting technique you have to do to have the energy for the stage when you're playing an energyless character?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of the actors before every rehearsal warm up together and sort of get within the world of the play and develop their sense of desperation or frustration, which is just the ultimate, I guess, feeling of these characters. It's just that they're so worn down by the task of waiting for this Gatto, whoever that is, or whatever that is. And so it's really miserable. And so I guess that's kind of where I'm getting most of my playable characteristics for Estragon from, is from just this pain and desperation that he's constantly feeling, physically, emotionally. I mean, he can't remember anything. His feet are killing him. He gets beaten every night. We find that out. And he's hot, he's thirsty, he can't go anywhere, he's hungry. It's just a lot of really horrible physical things that he's dealing with. And his best friend, Vladimir, is all he has to cling on to and for hope. And so I think that's really beautiful.
And best friend Vladimir, are you experiencing some of the same problems but just reacting in a very opposite way? Or are you not experiencing those problems?
Charlie has always said that these two characters are two sides of the same coin. And so we've kind of taken that to heart where Estragon is, lower energy, and Vladimir is always looking for the hope, is always bringing him up, is always keeping him waiting for Gatto. And they kind of help each other in those ways. And so by having this dichotomy of two people there almost, we have very different, a manic side and then a very depressive side almost. So that's kind of where we've found these two and balanced them out that way.
A lot of theater deals in the idea of character development in the course of the play. And so, Charlie, come back into this, but the two of you stay right in this thing. Would we call it character development, or what does happen through all this interminable wait? And you can quit talking if there's a spoiler alert in here
Well, there's no spoiler. This is the play that the critic Vivian Mercier says. He was famous for saying, this is the play where nothing happens twice, and yet we love it. It's we, as the audience, see these two tramps at complete in pain, sometimes physically, sometimes pain just within waiting, that they're terribly bored, and we're laughing. Patrick Stewart just got off stage with Ian McKellen on this about a year ago, and in a conversation that they had, he said, every line can be a laugh line in this play. And he's exactly right. But the characters can't find it funny. So that's part of the thing, is we see these two characters who, over the course of the play, they go deeper and deeper within this despair of waiting. And we sort of parallel that, and we come to laugh at them. And I think the real humor, outside of the text, is we see ourselves in these two men and in the other men that arrive and torment Vladimir and Estragon. We see ourselves in them. And the greatest gift of this play is we get to laugh at ourselves, that essentially we're just waiting too. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what these characters have for us.
So then back to the actors, you've had this response, building this job to create things. What has that done to your insides and your thoughts about greater issues, about meaning? Anybody want to jump in on that one? Good luck.
Well, we had a wonderful person come to one of our rehearsals and speak to us. She's Irish. What was her?
Roisin Lally. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's a professor at Gonzaga, and she's Irish, and she kind of gave us a talk.
And Beckett was Irish too.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And so, I mean, the play's written, I think, originally for the Irish dialect. A lot of the rhythm kind of lends itself to that. But she kind of gave us a talk about suffering and how the Irish people have suffered very, very much. And their response to that, and I think like the general human response when people are suffering so intimately, is to laugh at it, because that's all you can really do, or you go crazy. And I think that really inspired me and kind of let me see this play in a new light as an actor. Like Charlie said, like Estragon and Vladimir can't think their situation is funny necessarily, but through the suffering, they find their own ways to distract themselves and just make the best of it at every moment they possibly can. Otherwise, you know, they're going to lose it. And that is what I think the audience can see and can take away from it. You know, in their own lives, they can see these people suffering. And even though it's just heartbreaking on one hand, on the other hand, it's kind of hilarious for some reason.
So next time you have to do a frustrating, interminable wait, you will have some material inside you.
Yeah.
Perfect. I want to move toward the visual on this and interject that if one goes to our website, kpbx.org, right on the homepage there is the basic photo of the four actors in their clay-covered costumes, and then there's a link to the other photos from this. And so if you can do that, go right now, because then we'll do a better job of communicating the visual on radio. But with that in mind, J.J. McCracken, who is, as Charlie said, the hired gun.
Hi.
Yeah, let's move everything around, and let's get some, and then... Or bring it to you.
Hi.
You are... What's your two or three word descriptor? A site installation artist?
I'm an installation artist. I call myself an artist simply, but I do installation. I build sculpture and I do performance.
Okay, and then you live far away from here in Maryland or some?
Yeah, I'm in Maryland, right on the edge of D.C.
OK. Okay, well, that's convenient too. So you got this gig to come to Spokane and do something visual about Waiting for Godot. I'll learn it by the end. And so how did you start? Where did you start in on this idea?
Matt Rude invited me to be visiting artist, and because he's teaching ceramics, we started to think about clay being part of it. And I use a lot of clay in my work. Recently, I haven't as much, so it was a chance to get back to it. And then when the conversation opened a little bit more widely with Charlie and Courtney and Abby, we started talking about climate change. And so we had I think maybe Charlie might have had an idea visually that he wanted to explore, but I asked him not to give me anything visual, just to give me a list of words. And so we just started spinning from there. And then I have some touchstone images that I've been working off of. So the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is one that's a reference in what I've built.
And let me also pull back to a couple practical things. This is all taking place at the Washington Cracker Building, also known as the Terrain Building. Conceptually, it's just north of 2nd Avenue and just east of Washington Street, that big red building there. And right out in the parking lot is the installation. I saw it this morning. Is it complete right now?
Yeah, last night we finished it.
You finished it, and so the installation is there. So, and one can go to the pictures. So we're not giving away to things to say that with your idea of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, you found refuse to start with.
Yeah, well, it's a great opportunity to work with the theater department because there's a great prop shop, and Courtney sort of invited me to pilfer anything, so I got
a way to clean up the prop shop.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Refrigerators and stoves and all kinds of oil barrels and all kinds of junk, so I wanted to make a massive junk pile, and we did it.
Okay, and then talk about the clay metaphor that's been running around. Did that come from you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think it was an opportunity working with Matt to revisit clay. I have picked it apart in many ways in my work over 2.5 decades. But right now, in this piece, I'm sort of thinking of it as burial. And so we've poured I'm just roughly estimating about 1.5 tons puddle of clay into a frame and allowed it to dry out. We built a tree, and we've covered that with clay as well. And at this point, it's kind of a hard fragment that will weather over time, and it's on a slope. So it's going to move down over the junk pile and sort of help to rebury all this waste. All the waste is connected to consumption and the trains and what they're hauling behind this set.
That was convenient, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had elements to work with. When I got to the site, I had photos coming in, and then I got to the site, there's the train, there's the Cracker Building and its history. And then there's this sort of broken down architectural fragment. It's a plinth or a platform. And those are just great challenges to try to respond to and figure out what content they can bring.
And so, again, back to kind of a prosaic thing. In the actual event, and this, by the way, it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2, this weekend, when people come, is the play inside?
No, outdoor.
The play is the play is right there. So this is, JJ, you created the set, as it were, for the play. Can we call it that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think of it as an artwork, as an installation, and then a play is being performed on it. That's how I think about it.
And then do you, or does this even matter, do the actors interact with that?
Absolutely.
They're aware of it.
Yeah.
They see where they are.
Yeah, and there are bits of the installation that are, you can operate. So there's stoves that open, there's adding machines with buttons to press. There's lots of things that are actionable by the actors. And that's the idea. I mean, the whole idea behind Zaglab is to get everybody outside of their silos, working only within theater processes or only within art processes, and to mix it up. And so this has been part of the great process. JJ's creating an installation that's durational. It's there. It has to stand alone from the performance. But then the performance has to respond to that dynamically. And of course, we have to respond to the trains dynamically that come at random intervals. Mm-hmm. And so it's a giant conversation and a really great conversation throughout the process.
So you'll have chairs set up outside, audience seating, or will the audience simply stand around?
Bleachers, yeah, we're bringing in bleacher seating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm going to ask the inappropriate question. It might rain Thursday night.
Yeah.
And so where is that at? Does that just make the play almost better?
It does make it almost better. Unless it's a thunderstorm, the show will go on. And that's part of the thing. The installation is designed to work with the weather. When Matt and JJ poured the ton and a half of clay that day, it rained. It was that big 10-minute thunderstorm we had. So you see the remnants of that in the top of the clay pile. So
it's just more physical stuff. And as a performance artist, I love that stuff to respond to. And you can't fake it. And it makes it more real and more human. And the chance of failure is there. I worry they're going to slip on something in the clay, but as long as they got their knee pads on, you know, and aren't horribly injured, it just gives more to respond to physically. I imagine that has to be interesting in theater, too.
So, Abby and Courtney, are some of these your unique issues to have to deal with to make sure it happens no matter what?
That's kind of my whole job, is to make sure everyone's safe and everyone's ready and everyone's good to go, and to make the call if I have to, that, oh God, there's lightning coming down, we're going to cancel the show. Yeah. But yeah, making sure everyone's happy and ready and safe.
Mm-hmm. But and then again, this is for everybody in the room. There is this sense that, is art something that is carefully protected in completely controlled spaces by which then nothing can get in the way, and if there's a crying baby, that ruined the play for you that night, and that sense of art, which is real and, sure. and which is how it is, and you're just running 180 degrees counter to that whole mentality, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm really interested in the way that theater can be overly controlled, or art can be overly controlled, and sanitized. This part of the question that I brought into this is, how do we make theater that is completely responsive and that can be dynamic evening to evening? The weather's different. The site itself has changed because of last night's weather or last night's performance. And so that really every performance has to be dynamic and different. The train schedules are never the same night to night. I'm curious as a director about, what are those things that make theater distinct? And one of the things is that this liveness, but even liveness in the theater can get overly controlled. And so one of the things that I think we all wanted to do with this production is to throw out any sort of element that we can overly control. We can control the actor's safety. That's important. Everything else is dynamic and responding to the other elements, which makes it exciting. For the artists, I think, but also exciting for the audience, because we really don't know when the train's coming, and we really don't know how the site is going to degrade from night to night.
It's so, never the same show.
It can't be the same show every night. Yeah.
And back to you, JJ. Tell a story you were telling earlier about your interaction with some of the neighbors, some of the street people there when you showed up to do the installation.
Well, first of all, I flew in on Friday, and Matt took me to the site so we could look at it. And the next morning, we moved a really big pile of junk over to the site and a platform that was sort of a skeleton for the form. And that was a heavy lifting day. We went home. We came back the next day. And as soon as we rolled up, there were two men digging through the pile. And I asked them what they were looking for, and they said they were trying to find copper in everything. So they started to walk away. I think they maybe like got turned off by our sense of ownership over this pile of junk. And I instantly just called them back and figured, I don't need the copper. You know, they can do a lot more with it, and it might help us to get rid of all the copper now so there'd be maybe less destruction later on. throughout the summer. So Matt left and went and got more tools, and we just spent the next 5 or 6 hours while we were building and moving things around, helping them open anything that might have copper in it. We got them shopping bags to put it all in and carry it away. And we asked them a lot of questions about what, you know, where they would sell it and how much they'd get for it. So we learned a lot, and they were very, it was like a reciprocal moment. Like, we learned a lot. We also got rid of all this copper. We stuck things in the TVs to keep them open so that anyone, you know, looking to harvest any more could see that it was already gone, already stripped.
Yeah, because, again, with all of this thought that we're going to be totally open to anything, you still want some sculpture left by the by next September, I suppose. Even though
I just release it. You know, it's it's not mine anymore. It's theirs.
Yeah, that's the mystery. In September, what are we going to be performing on? And so that's the risk we're taking with the production.
You know, the tree could break, a branch could break, and that's all content.
But the tree is essential to the story of the play.
Absolutely.
So you need to have that.
I don't think it can come down completely. There'll be something that's tree-like.
Yeah, for it. This is Waiting for Godot. We've told the story pretty well, or what side of it we haven't. I mean, we probably shouldn't set up the audience too much, but we were talking earlier, there's all kinds of implications of how you can take it. Go ahead and suggest a couple of other things that related to current events one might think about.
Well, let me read you a section. Vladimir says this in Act Two. He's speaking to the audience at this point, and he says, "What are we doing here? That's the question." And he says, "Let us represent worthily for once." And he says, "But at this place, at this moment of time, all mankind is us, whether we like it or not, and let's make the most of it." And I think if you boil the play down, if you squeeze the play, that's the line that really jumps out at me.
Give us that final line again.
Oh, gosh, let me find it again.
Oh, you did.
It is, "But at this place, at this moment of time, all mankind is us, whether we like it or not. And let's make the most of it."
So let's leave it right there. This is Waiting for Godot. And it is 7:30 tonight. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. It's 2:00 Sunday afternoon. The sculpture will be up all summer, and then something like the 8th through the 11th of September, the play will return.
Right, and tickets are available online. Mm-hmm. We're selling those through Terrain. And if you go to Eventbrite, search for Terrain. You can go to the Bitly link, which is bit.ly/terrainzaglab, and that'll take you right to that ticket site.
And thanks to Google, one can probably get there even with
no
not quite
it.
All that much information.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming in on this.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Vern.